I turned it on?
Yes.
Today, I am going to tell you all about level one modular forms.
In the future, we can start talking about higher level modular forms. I might actually do a ridiculous amount today and skip a number of details and just highlight the key points from the notes. So what you should have is the rest of chapter one here. So that's the notes labeled 1.4 at the top and then the notes labeled 1.7 at the top. And there's a new homework assignment, which I had it on Monday also. So here we go. So the first thing is here's an example of a modular form of level one and wave k. Namely, I'm giving it to you completely explicitly. I'll call it ek, and it's minus bk over 2k, I'll define bk in a second, plus q plus sum of the n goes from 2 to infinity, sigma k minus 1 to n, q to the n. So this is completely explicit. It's a formal power series. Here the bk are defined as follows. They're rational numbers, and they were studied by Bernoulli, some Bernoulli. I don't know which Bernoulli, but they've been around for a while. And they're defined as follows. You simply consider the equality, they're defined by the equality of the following two expressions. X divided by e to the x minus 1, and sum n equals 0 to infinity, x to b sub n, x to the n over n factorial. So this, if you multiply it all out, you get a formal power series. It looks like following 1 minus x over 2 plus x squared over 12, and so on. And this defines the Bernoulli numbers. The coefficients when you expand this out are, of course, rational numbers, because you know explicitly what the power series of e to the x is, and you know how to divide power series. And you just compare corresponding coefficients, and that defines b sub n. And there's a nice table on page 17 of the notes of various values of b sub n. When n is odd, b sub n is 0, except when n equals 1. And the even b sub n are very interesting. They're listed here. For example, b sub 4 is equal to minus 1 over 30, and b sub 6 is equal to 1 over 42. So you have a bunch of rational numbers, b sub n, and these are two of them. And this is specific for k even, k greater than or equal to 4. This is an element of mk slqz. It's a modular form of weight k and level 1. And this is its power series at infinity. But it also defines it as a holomorphic function. It's a function of z, where your q is e to the 2 pi iz. Of course, the natural question is, what happens when k equals 2? Well, you still get something that's holomorphic, but it doesn't satisfy the condition to be a modular form. So, it's kind of a problem. So e2 is not a modular form. This doesn't work. It turns out there's if you add 1 over the, or some constant multiple of your orders, I think it's 1 over the imaginary part of z to e2. So there's an expression like this, and this will satisfy the modularity property, but it fails to be holomorphic. Basically, you have a 1 over y here if you write z as x plus iy. So you can make it satisfy the modularity condition, namely, that when you hit it by every element of SL2Z, you get back the same thing, but then it isn't holomorphic anymore. So you can't have both holomorphic and satisfying the modularity condition. So there's a problem there. There is a chaotic analog of modular forms that was introduced from one point of view by Serre, and in another point of view by Katz. And in a chaotic context, there is a notion of E2, and it turns out to play a fundamental role in much of the theory of chaotic modular forms. So if you want to understand E2 as a modular form, you have to consider chaotic modular forms. And this summer, I wrote a paper on computing this P p-adic moduli form explicitly with Tate and Mazur. Okay, so that's just a quick aside. Okay, so this is an example of a modular form of level 1, and you get everything by taking this modular form and for various k and doing some arithmetic with them. So I'm going to skip a bunch and tell you a theorem, which is just a precise version I told you a second ago. This is theorem 1.5.6, the same type. It says that mk SL2Z, this is the space of all holomorphic modular forms of weight k and level 1. So this is first just by definition, just to remind you, this is simply by definition the set of all functions F on the upper half plane such that F is holomorphic. So it has a derivative everywhere. And F bar gamma k equals F for all gamma in SL2Z. And where F bar gamma k is by definition CZ plus D to the minus k, F is gamma Z. CZ plus D minus K F of gamma Z. And here, gamma is equal to A, B, C, D. Okay, so this is, it's a set of functions, it's closed under addition, and it's not all clear that it's not empty, it's not at all clear that it has finite dimension, but in fact it does have finite dimension. It has a basis.
Do the requirements for this count include holomorphic identity?
Yes, that's why I put the H star here. H star is H union the cusps, and by F being holomorphic, I mean it's holomorphic on its entire domain.
Okay.
This is just a shorthand for that. H union Q minus 2. So I definitely am requiring holomorphic at infinity. Holomorphic absolutely everywhere, including at infinity. Holomorphic infinity meant that that its Q expansion has no negative powers of Q appearing in it. For example, this one. This is holomorphic at infinity. So this has the following basis. It's very simple. You just take, I'll state it slightly differently than the notes, but it's completely equivalent. Take E4 to the A times E6 to the B, where A and B are greater than or equal to 0, they're integers, and 4A plus 6B is equal to K. So all this is you take the monomials in E4 and E6 that have weight K, where you get that from the fact that E4 to the A has weight 4A, and E6 to the B, when you multiply two modular forms, the weights add, so if you multiply E6 times itself, B times, you end up getting 6B. So you take all of the ones that have weight K, take them all together, and you get all the modular forms of weight K. That's a theorem. It's not trivial to prove. The key input is the residue theorem from complex analysis. You prove modulo the residue theorem is given in the notes. So that's the one part that I leave out. So I'm not going to prove this in class. So the proof, for complete proof, assuming you have complex analysis, you can see Sarah spoke a course in arithmetic, and for the proof without it's just one key input, referring to Sarah, you can see the book, so see notes. But this is a useful thing because it says that now, just from what I've written on the board, I've given you enough to quickly devise an algorithm to compute mk SL2Z. There's enough there. You can certainly compute this thing. You have to factor n, but, well, I mean, if you only want to compute some coefficients of this, that's okay. So there's enough here. You just write down E4 and E6 explicitly with some precision, And then you compute all of these, and you're guaranteed to have obtained a basis for MKSL2Z. So it's pretty straightforward to compute MKSL2Z. Except for the fact that very quickly people are interested in, say, K around 3,000 or 4,000, and then this gets pretty unwieldy to even write down or to do anything with. But at least it's not a terrifyingly complicated thing to try to compute this space. From this, you can also figure out what the dimension is. So that's the corollary 1.5.5. The dimension of MK, very simple formula. It's, well, when K is odd, there isn't anything, as you proved in your homework problems that you do today. So when K is odd, it has dimension 0. And it's the floor of K over 12 if K is 2 mod 12. So, for example, when K equals 2, you don't get anything like this, and this is 0. When K equals 14, can anybody think of a pair AB that works here for K equals 14?
2 1.
Okay. Yeah, yes, so 2 1. 8 plus 6 is 14. And there's just that one, so in fact you do get 1 here. In the other cases, it's K over 12 quantity plus 1. Okay, so that's the dimension. So it's a very simple formula. It's almost linear in K, except for the fact you take the floor. So, but it's essentially linear in K. That's how you should think of the growth as being. So if you wanted to quickly estimate the dimension of M sub, 2004 of SL2Z, without any further thought, you just quickly try to divide that by 12, or if you're really just estimating, divide it by 10. So it's going to be something a little bit less than 200. So you can quickly deduce the dimension of this space once you have this theorem. And if you wanted to actually compute it, well, you could run through. See, these are these integers are not negative, so you just run through values of say b between 0 and k over 6, and then solve for a and see whether or not it's an integer, and then you just run through all of them, and that will give you the expressions that you should consider. So you could compute this space. All right, so what's next? So I'm going to skip the proof of the structure theorem. That's what this is also called. Don't want to say anything about it. Really, the main input is understanding very carefully what happens for weights up to and including 12 and maybe 14. So you understand very well the low weights via understanding zeros of holomorphic functions. And then you consider a certain element of weight 12, delta. So this is an element of S12. By the way, first let me say it's an element of M12. SL2Z. And if you consider its Q expansion, its power series expansion, the constant term is 0. The things with constant term 0 are called cusp forms, and they're denoted S12 SL2Z, the cusp forms of weight 12. The reason you use the letter S is because the German word for cusp form begins with S. It's something like Spitzen form. So in fact, delta isn't there. And this delta, well, it gives you a map from MK SL2Z to, I mean, it's a function on the upper half plane, but if you multiply by it, you get a map to MK plus 12 SL2Z. So this is a modular form here is 2. That modular form multiplied by delta. And delta doesn't have any zeros except at infinity, so you can understand a lot about going in the other direction. So you understand this map very well, you have an inclusion like this. So you understand this map very well, and that's what the most of the work in the structure theorem is about. And once you understand the map well, you can really figure out, you can really show that you get everything here by some kind of induction. Okay, that's just a quick sketch of how you prove this structure theorem. Example 1.5.8 in the notes has a completely explicitly given basis when the weight is 24. So that's the first case in which the dimension is bigger than 2. right here. And you can see the numbers are quite big already. So they have these huge denominators, etc. Part of the problem is you have this 2k out front here. So kind of close up. Actually, why should that get so big? Well, I guess you're taking it to a power, so you kind of close. Wait, what's the question? Oh, sorry. It's the sum of the k minus first powers of the divisors.
Is equal to sum over 1 less than or equal to d dividing n of d to the power k minus 1.
So, for example, when n is prime, it's 1 plus n to the power k minus 1. So you can see explicitly what this basis looks like. It's not so pretty as illustrated there, but you can write it down. All right, now I'm going to state lemma 1.61, which is called, which is a lemma in the PhD thesis of Victor Miller, and I'll prove that lemma. Now there's one thing, the proof that I have here is essentially copied from this surprisingly nice book by Serge Lange on modular forms. Unfortunately, I was looking at it, it seems to be that there's some typos in the proof that I literally copied from Lange. Like, the typos persisted over here. So we will see in the course of proving it that I think something has to be switched. I looked it up and I literally just copied it straight over, including the typo. I mean, at least I copied that typo. So we'll see as that occurs. Let me tell you about the Victor Miller basis. So you have a basis like this. This is a basis. This is a theorem that this is a basis. And if you look at example 158, you see that it's in some sense an ugly basis. There are lots of very large denominators that appear there. It doesn't look very pretty. It's certainly not in reduced row echelon form, for example. What would that mean for power series, reduced row echelon form? By that I simply mean, if you view the power series as sort of these very long vectors going off this way, just take the coefficients of the power series and view those as the coordinates of a vector, and you have this finite list of vectors, even though the vectors are infinitely long, you can imagine putting that in reduced row echelon form, taking the first non-zero entry and clearing that column, and doing the same with the second one, and the same with the third one, and you get some reduced row echelon form. The question is, if you take this rather unpleasant-looking basis at level 1 and put it in reduced row echelon form, what do you get? What does the resulting basis look like? And it turns out it's very nice. What you get is the identity matrix, and then you get the rest of the matrix, if you like, and the rest of the vectors in reduced row echelon form all have integer entries. So it's as nice as you could hope for. And I'm going to prove that for you right now.
Killing its lemma, huh? For his PhD thesis?
Yeah, it's just a lemma. So, yeah, it wasn't his whole thesis. I haven't actually got to look at his thesis, but should.
How long ago did he write this thesis?
I don't know.
I mean, about like 50 or 10 years.
Let's see. Well, he's about, I think he's about 50 now. So he probably wrote it 20, 25 years ago or so. 20 to 25 years ago. He's one of the two people that really started elliptic curve cryptography. He and Neil Kollwitz were, I think, two of the people that really got elliptic curve cryptography going in the first place. That's one of his claims to fame. He works at CCR, but not the one here, the one in Princeton, in case you're curious. So, I've met him a few times. He's a really nice guy. So, Victor Miller's thesis. That's my goal for right now, is to prove Victor Miller's thesis. That is to say, prove the lemma of Victor Miller. So, lemma. Victor Miller. And this is, again, simply answering the question, what does the reduced row echelon form of this basis look like, where, again, reduced row echelon form is in the sense I described. Okay, so I'll state it exactly as in the notes. So there's a slight difference in what I've been saying, but in fact, I'll make a remark that will give exactly what I've claimed, that I really that it looks like what I claimed. But I'm going to state something slightly weaker initially, and then at the end we will get exactly the claim I made. So SK, which is by definition SK SL2Z, which is the subspace of MK SL2Z. It's the subspace of elements that have zero constant term at infinity. And by the way, SL2Z is equal to, in fact, a direct sum of SL2Z, SK SL2Z, and a one-dimensional space spanned by EK. So, so in any case, SK is a certain subspace of MK, and has a basis with the following properties. So it has, SK has a basis F1 through FB. So D is here, by definition, the dimension of SK. Has a basis F1 through FD such that here I'm going to write AI of FJ to mean the ith coefficient in the Q expansion of FJ. So that's what I mean by that. AI of FJ is equal to delta IJ. So it's 1 if I equals J, and 0 if I is not equal to J. And the Fi, actually the Fj, they're all power series with coordinates in Z, with coefficients in Z. So let's see. If you skip ahead in the notes to example 1.6.4, you'll see a basis for weight 36 modular forms of level 1. And if you look at F1, F2, and F3, in that basis, in example 1.6.4 on page 21, do you have a copy of the notes? Can you give me a copy? Oh, but I think the notes are better because I keep changing the, keep improving the book before I. Let's say the printing out bigger. So, okay, actually, here, 1.6.4. So notice that it's a very nice basis. You have, at the beginning, you have basically like the identity matrix. You have just 1, and then 0, then you have a cube, q squared, q cubed. And then after that, you have these integer coefficient power series. So that's what this says. It says that bases look like the one in example 1.6.4. Okay? And I'm just writing it down with notation. Now, prove it.
And I'll prove it. Prove.
Actually, I thought that this lemma was hard before I saw the proof. And I mentioned it to Scott Algrim, who's a professor at Urbana-Champaign. And he said, we're just standing outside of a restaurant waiting for somebody to show up. And like in 2 minutes, he's like, oh, I see how to do that. And I thought, okay, maybe it's not so hard. So I better figure out how to do this. So it isn't hard, so as you'll see in a second. So here's what we're going to do. So remember, I defined E4 and E6 a minute ago, and I'm going to define F4 and F6. These are exactly like E4 and E6, except I'm going to rescale them so that the leading coefficient is 1. So F4 is, by definition, this is just what you have to do in order to rescale it so that the leading coefficient is 1. That's 2k at the top, and then B4 here, times E4. And explicitly, this looks like 1 plus 242, plus 2160q squared, and so on. And then F6 is minus 12 over B6 times E6, plus 1 minus
504q minus 16632 squared. Let's not that.
So these are two forms. F4 is in M4, just because it's a scalar multiple of something, and this one's in M6. And I mentioned delta before. Delta is, as I discussed on Monday, it's a simple linear combination of things involving powers of F4 and F6. So we take exactly the right linear combination of, well, G4 is a scalar multiple of E4, C2. Actually, the exact coefficients don't matter, so. So this will be the best way to write Q plus inverter terms. Okay, so F4 cubed has weight 12, F6 squared has weight 12, and there's some linear combination of the two of them that exactly cancels off the constant term and gives you a linear term with a coefficient of 1, and that's the linear combination I need here. And that completely determines these scalars. It might be a good homework problem to do that. Actually, it's pretty easy, I think, for starters, because F4 cubed has leading coefficient 1. So to cancel off the, you need these two, one's the negative of the other. So if you call this alpha and this one beta, then this other one's got to be minus alpha.
And since we know that it's cubed, we can just change and just write out.
Yeah, let's work it out.
240 cubed.
So it's going to be alpha. You might as well assume one of these is 1. Oh, wait, no, I can't assume this one, sorry. Okay, so it's going to be alpha times, well, we have to find the cube of that and find a linear term of the cube.
It's impossible.
What? It's impossible.
Too big.
It's impossible to do in your, it would be tedious to do in your head right now. If you were a manager, you just instantly know what it is. Because a goddess would tell you. Okay, so we won't work out what alpha is, but there's some alpha in this. Okay, so these are the three players that will be important in proving this lemma. So here's how you prove it.
It's really straightforward, except for the small problem that the proof in Leibniz has a typo that was copied from Lane. But besides that, it shouldn't be hard.
The spirit of the proof is there. So here's what you choose. We're fixing a k right here in the input of the lemma, and we're going to do something. So choose a and b. These are integers, they're greater than or equal to 0, and you want 4a plus 6b to be less than or equal to 14. And we also want, so that's not quite enough to determine them yet, obviously, there's a lot of possibilities. We want 4a plus 6b, this number that's less than or equal to 14, to be congruent to k mod 12. And that's still not quite enough to determine them, because if k were 14, you'd have two possibilities. Is that true? Actually, that's not true. If k is 12, you have two possibilities. Namely, they could both be 0, or they could be 3. We have a couple of choices. We have, I guess, three different possibilities when k is 12. So in that one case, let's say, a equals b equals 0 when k is congruent to 12 mod, k is congruent to 0 mod 12. So this is enough to completely determine a and b. Let's think about that for a second. So already, when you make this condition, if you have a number that's between 0 and 14, and you fix what it is modulo 12, and it's even also, k is even here, since there's nothing when k is odd. This is sort of a trivial statement when k is odd, so you must assume k is even. So k is an even number here, so it's either, the only ambiguity is when k is divisible by 12, except I'm a little worried about 2. Well, no, you don't have to worry about 2 because there's no solutions to 4a plus, I mean, this will never be equal to 2. So you don't have to worry about that. So in the case of k is 2 by 12, you would choose 4a plus 6b to be equal to 14. Also, there's a unique choice of a and b for each number up to this range, except for 12, where you have two possibilities. For 12, if 4a plus 6b equals 12, there are two different ways that could happen. Namely, 3, 0, or 0, 2. But in that one case, we've done that.
Okay, so any questions about why this determines a and b uniquely? Completely elementary, number 3. Okay, good. All right, so now we have that. Now we're ready to proceed. I will simply write down, well, I won't write down this basis, but I will write down a basis which will have properties such that we can deduce the existence of this basis.
So, let, and here's where the mistake is, let GJ equal delta to the power of J F6 to the power of 2 D, remember, D is the dimension, minus J plus, in the notes it says A, but I think that's wrong. I think the proof only works if you put B times F4 to the power of, we're going to change it to A. And you do this for J equals 1 all the way up through D. So I've now written down a whole bunch of modular forms, and we'll have to verify two things. One, each of those has weight k. We need to check that. And the other, well, we need to understand what they look like. When you think about taking the coordinate vectors or coefficient vectors of these Q expansions and putting them in a matrix, what kind of matrix do you get? And the matrix you get will be upper triangular with ones down the diagonal and integer entries everywhere else. Once we see that, then when you do echelon form on the resulting matrix, you're always clearing a column using a 1, and you won't introduce any denominators by doing that, because you're always sort of in luck. You don't have to divide in order to clear the column. You just take minus whatever the other entry is times it. So let's see, first, let's do the easy part first, which is what does this look like, and then we'll verify that these happen to have weight k, and that's a little bit harder. But not too much harder. Okay, so take delta to the j. That starts out with q to the j, because after all, delta starts out with a q, and then you have higher order terms. And the other thing is in d double brackets q. That one's in q times d double brackets q, and these are in the power series over q. Over z, both in a variable q. Okay, so this delta to the j starts out q to the j plus higher order terms. What about f6 to this whatever power? What does that start out like? Very easy question. What's the first coefficient? 1, right? 1 plus higher order terms. It doesn't matter what power you raise it to. You're going to get 1 as the first coefficient. Okay? And likewise for f4 to the a. 1 plus higher order terms. So, these g sub j, if we can show that they're in mk, what we have is a whole bunch of different modular forms, and they start out, the very first non-zero entry is the coefficient of q to the j. All the coefficients are integers, and the coefficient of q to the j is 1. So we get a very nice collection of things. They're linearly independent, of course, because if you put them in a matrix, you get something upper triangular. So this will work. If we just take this and apply reduced row echelon form to it, then we get these f sub j. So all that remains is to prove that these are actually in Mk. Reach J
G sub J is in volume, in fact, in SK, SL2Z. Well, we know, because the product of two modular forms is a modular form, that this is a modular form of some weight, and we can work out the weight just by looking at what this product is. So, GJ is a modular form of weight. Well, delta has weight 12, so 12 times J, that's what you get from the first factor. Then the next factor, you have something of weight 6, and you're raising it to the power of 2 D minus J plus B. And then the next factor is 4 times A. So now that is the weight. That is the, K prime. I want to show that this is equal to K. So let's just multiply everything out and see if anything happens. Oh, it should be plus here, actually. I mean, let's see. The weights add when you multiply. The weight of this one is 12J. Now you add that to the weight of this one, which you add to the weight of this one. So sorry about that. So pluses. Okay, so that's 12J plus 12D minus 12J plus 6B plus 4A. And now 12J's cancel out, so you get 12D. Well, we know a lot about what that can be. 12D, 6B plus 4A, well, we chose A and B so that 6B plus 4A is congruent to K mod 12. So, so it's starting to look hopeful. So now we just have to figure out what the sum is, and we have to check in the various cases that this is really equal to K. The two cases are K is 2 mod 12 and K isn't 2 mod 12. Remember, I mentioned a formula for the dimension of MK, and SK has one dimension less. So let me recall that formula. So the dimension of MK, I mentioned this before, say for K even, and bring it into the 4, this is 4 of k over 12, when k is 2 mod 12, and it's the 4 of k over 12 plus 1 when k is not 2 mod 12, if I remember correctly. And then up.
Is that right? Yes. Okay, now sk has dimension 1 less, so.
So this is the dimension for SK. This case of cusp forms of weight K and level 1 has dimension this or that. So let's just consider the two cases here and see if in each case we end up with K. So first I'll consider the case that K is not 2 mod 12. Actually, I'll consider the case K is 2 mod 12 just so that this will line up with what's written over there. So let's see. So K is 2 mod 12. What is 4A plus 6B if K is 2 mod 12?
So I have to demonstrate that you understood the definition of the A and the B.
So in this case, K is 2 mod 12. What are A and B? You can tell me exactly what A and B are. Yes. It's the same. In fact, the second time one of you has told me what it is for that. So 2 and 1. So we now know exactly what it says. 12 times, we have the dimension formula over there, k over 12 4 minus 1 plus, and then what you said, 2 and 1, so 4 times 2 plus 6 times 1, or 14. Okay, and that's...
Are the 2 and 1 switched, or...
Oh, maybe.
So A is
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, actually, yeah.
A is 2?
But remember that in the notes, the A and B are switched.
Yeah. Oh, 6B yeah. Plus 4A is written.
Yeah, it's just because it's backwards up here. Okay. But yeah, I switched it back down here. Yes, thank you. So that's this. And in the other case, well, actually, let's just finish this one first. So this is 12 times the floor of k over 12. And then you get a minus 12 plus 14, so plus 2. So the question is that equal to k? So if you take the floor of a number, and let's see, what is this? So we want to know if that's, hold on. So obviously not equal to k.
Yeah, it is.
It is? Oh.
Yeah, because the k is converted to 2 mod 12.
Uh-huh.
So you lose 2 when you take the floor function, right? Isn't it?
Probably.
Yeah.
If you take like k
oh, yeah, yeah. 4. Yeah, you're right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you take any number at all and you divide it by d and take the floor, then multiply the result by d, and then add back the residue of the thing mod d, then you get back the original number. It's a quotient and a remainder. This is the quotient. And this is the remainder. Thank you. Yay. So, to Stephanie, it works, and we end up with k. So, one case down, one k down, and now the other one. Now, k is not 2 mod 12. So, here we have 12 times the floor of k over 12. Because that's the dimension. And then we have to add 4a plus 6b. But when k is not 2 mod 12, let's see. Worry about this for a second. I think it's okay. So the number we're getting is definitely k modulo 12. 4a plus 6b, it's something that's k modulo 12, and it's not 14. So it's something between 0 and 12, excluding the 12. That is congruent to k modulo 12. So it's what you might call in C, k modulo 12. That's what 4a plus 6b is. Okay, you know what I mean by this. The residue when you divide 12 into k and take the remainder. And again, it's exactly the same thing that we mentioned before. This is equal to k. And that's why it was important to take a equal to b equal to 0 in this case, because you really wanted that 4a plus 6b was equal to the residue of k modulo 12. Okay, so we've now proved that gj is a modular form of weight k. And the basis of the gj has the right shape so that when you compute its reduced row echelon form, or when you consider it, then it's just exactly what I claimed initially. So we've now completely proved Victor Miller's lemma. Okay? And again, now look at example 1.6.4. There it is. You have explicitly a basis. There's one little subtlety, which is that I have an F0 there. And how do you do that? Well, once you have this Victor Miller basis, which is what it's called, I named it that, but I think that's a good name for it. So you have F1 through FD, and they're in reduced row echelon form. You have all integer entries. If you take one of these Eisenstein series that lies in your space, just take some f4 to some power times f6 to some other power, that's leading coefficient 1, and then you can take the rest of your basis and subtract off integer multiples of all the other basis elements, and you end up with something that starts out with 1 and then has zeros everywhere up to q to the dimension plus 1, q to the d plus 1. So you can also throw in an extra thing so that you have a basis for mk that is also the identity matrix and then integer entries elsewhere. Okay? So this is a sort of a canonical basis for level 1 modular forms, or modular forms of weight k on SL2z. It's canonical because it's the reduced row echelon form. You take any basis at all for level 1, you compute its reduced row echelon form, you will get this basis that starts out with the identity matrix and then has integer entries afterwards.
Okay, so any questions about that? So now I'm going to move on to Hecke operators, which are really where much of the action and interest is at when it comes to modular forms. For example, their Manogen tau function has a lot of neat properties, this delta. Its coefficients are multiplicative. And a way of proving that the coefficients of delta are multiplicative is to prove that delta is an eigenvector for each of the Hecke operators. And from the properties of Hecke operators, it would then follow that the coefficients are multiplicative. In general, whenever you have an eigenvector for Hecke operators, the coefficients are multiplicative. So if you have some arithmetic function and you want to prove its coefficients are multiplicative, one approach might be, if the arithmetic function happens to be coefficients of a modular form, to prove that your thing is an eigenform. In any case, that's the next story. So Hecke operators. These are really, really important in the theory of modular forms. There are a lot of different Hecke operators all over the place that have nothing to do with the Hecke operators, as far as I can tell, I'm talking about today. But in representation theory, there are Hecke operators. If you look at the abstract for the colloquium tomorrow, which is extremely long, you'll notice Hecke, I think Hecke operator or Hecke algebra appears in the abstract. I don't understand any other word in the whole abstract. It's some analysis thing. There's Hecke operators there. Don't think that you're learning about every Hecke operator ever right now. What I'm going to describe for you is, so in general you have, for any congruent subgroup gamma, let's see, do you have them for any congruents? Maybe you don't actually. Be careful, I think actually I'm going to assume something about it. So take gamma 1 and n. For example, n equals 1 gives you SL2z. Then there's a whole bunch of linear transformations of this space called T sub n. They're indexed by the positive integers. So these are linear transformations. They're homomorphisms from the space to itself. They're complex linear. Think of them as being given by a matrix if you choose a basis. You have one for each positive integer. And they have a lot of nice properties. For example, they commute. So Tn times Tm equal to Tm times Tn. So what one does is considers, so by the way, this is called the Hecke operator T sub n. I'll give you a definition in a minute. I'll delay for a second. So you let T be the ring, Z adjoining T1, T2, T3, and so on. And this fact that the Hecke operators commute, which is pretty extraordinary to have some finite dimensional space and a whole load of commuting operators acting on it, but they commute, so when you take this ring generated by all of them, you get a commutative ring. And you can show that if you view this ring as a module over Z, it's a finite ring. So it's something kind of like the ring of integers of a number field, but possibly more complicated. But it acts on here, and if, for example, and this isn't always the case, though it is the case at level 1, if each of these matrices is diagonalizable over the complex numbers, then you can simultaneously diagonalize. That's a basic fact from linear algebra. If you have commuting diagonalizable linear transformations, you can simultaneously diagonalize them. And then you can then you would get a basis for this of eigenvectors where these act diagonally. Let's see. So I'm just giving you some quick sketch. Now I'll go into some more details with some actual definitions. Yes?
So does that mean a finite subset of the TIs generates all of them?
That's true, actually. Yes. And in fact, that was something that, when I was in grad school, we wondered about this a lot and asked around
So if you're going to do computations with T, it would be nice if, as a module, it was just generated by, say, T1 through TP, where you could figure out P explicitly. I mean, maybe the P wouldn't be the minimal one, but you could find some P that's generated as a module by these matrices or operators. So Amuda Gashi and I, who are two graduate students, asked around, and Ken Ribbett and Louis Morel both told us about some paper by some guy named Sturm, not the famous Sturm, but another Sturm, in case there is a famous Sturm. And it was just some paper from, I think, the 80s. It wasn't that. It was from the 1980s, I think. And it's not that, not that Sturm. So it's a paper from the 1980s. And there he proves something about congruences between modular forms. He says if you have two modular forms and the coefficients are congruent modulo a prime p up to some bound, then all of the coefficients are congruent. So that's kind of a nice thing to know. And he gives an explicit bound. And Ribbett told us about this standard thing that relates the Hecke algebra, this thing, to congruences between modular forms. So we took that and, following their advice, wrote down an explicit bound here. Because it's not too deep once you have all these other things. So it's, k over 6 times the index in SL2z of your congruent subgroup, so gamma 1 of n, or gamma 0 of n, or whatever. So this is the bound. I think that's right. That's right. So, for example, if k is 12, so this is 1 in the case of level 1, so that's 2 in the case of 1. Let's see, there's one thing. This bound is only valid for cusp forms, so you have to take the Hecke operators preserve the subspace of cusp forms, sk, gamma 1, then. And if you take the Hecke algebra, consider the Hecke operators but restricted to the cusp forms, then this is the correct bound. So this is on cusp forms. I don't think I know, actually, what the answer is if you don't restrict to cusp forms. But it would be this plus something simple, which I actually really need to work out in order to correctly program some stuff in Sage. And currently I have a comment that says using fake bound in a case when it has to compute the sum modular forms. So there's plus some extra constant in the case when it's not just the cusp forms. But when you restrict all the Hecke operators to the subspace of cusp forms, then take the collection of matrices you get there, assuming we fixed a basis, then this is a bound on the number that's needed to generate. And there's a proof of this, let's see. So if you look in a paper by Scoff and Lario, this is the same Scoff of the SEA algorithm for point counting on elliptic curves. They have a paper that has an appendix that Amuda Gashi and I wrote. It's a one-page appendix that proves this bound. And amusingly, I bet that gets referenced a lot more than the paper itself, even though it's just this one-page appendix. Also, in the notes for this course, or at least the book that I'm basing the notes for this course on, I think the last chapter is a re-exposition of Sturm's original argument. So you don't have to look up Sturm's paper for that. So I think that's an answer to your question. So this Scoff thing, I was at MSRI in Berkeley at a conference, and Scoff was trying to do some calculation involving Hecke algebras related to the sort of properties of Hecke algebras that go into Weil's proof of Fermat's theorem. And he couldn't do the calculations because he didn't know an explicit bound on the generators, on the number of things needed to generate. If you don't know a bound like this, you'll never know when you're done. You just keep adding in more Hecke operators, but how do you know that you have all of them? So I told him about this bound, and then that's when he asked for a reference, I said there wasn't one, so that's why we wrote an appendix to that paper. Okay, so now let me tell you what Hecke operators are. Again, this is definition 1.7.1 in the notes. So it's actually pretty there's a lot of different ways to define these, but here's what I'll do. The problem is the natural ways take a lot of work to understand, and the straightforward way looks somewhat contrived. So here's the straightforward definition, which looks somewhat contrived. So I'm now writing down a finite set of 2x2 integer matrices. They're all upper triangular. The matrices A, B, 0, D, where A is greater than or equal to 1, A, D is equal to N, and D satisfies that bound. So 0 less than or equal to B less than D. So this is a finite set of matrices. Let's see if it's clear that it's finite. Notice that A is positive by definition. D, well, it's strictly bigger than 0, so it's positive. So these are both positive. The product is N. So there are only finitely many possibilities for A and D. They're like ways of partitioning N into partitioning the factors of N into two partitions. And then B is just, well, once you choose A and D, you get to choose any value of B in this range. So you define S of N that way. And here's the definition of the Heck operator. So I'm going to emphasize the K in the notation for a moment. So T and K, this is, I'm going to take a modular form F of weight K to the following. You just sum over the elements of S sub N, and you hit them by gamma. Now there is an important issue here, which is that I only defined this notation in the case when gamma was an element of SL2Z. And here it's not. So I have to define this notation for you. Where, if you remember the notation, there's a factor of the determinant that's going to be here. This could be totally wrong. But the other two, are you sure? That sounds right, but I'm a little worried because it's supposed to make sense for odd data.
What if your determinant is 0 and your k is negative 2?
What?
What if your determinant is 0 and your k equals negative 2?
The determinant isn't 0.
Okay, because they don't have that.
Yeah. I will look this up right now, but
I think it's, dang it. My memory says k over 2, but that doesn't make sense to me. So, sorry. It's some power of k. What is it? I think it's in here. And if it isn't, I know where to look. I am annoyed. I think I had the definition in here and then I deleted it, but k minus 1, it looks like. So if you, this is stupid, but if you look on page 21, I have the statement F bar P, so that's the matrix. This is sort of second paragraph on page 21. I have the matrix P00P, and I say that the extra factor is P squared, that's the determinant to the power K minus 1.
So I think this is supposed to be K minus 1. It does fit with my memory of what this is supposed to be.
And it also, see, the thing is, if you put k over 2, it simply wouldn't make sense when k is odd. So that can't be right.
So this is the extra factor, which you forget about in the case when when gamma has determinant 1. You don't have to worry about it. But in general, you do. Notice here, the matrices all have determinant n. So, in all cases, you have an extra factor of n to the k minus 1 out front. So that's it. That's the definition of T and k. So let's think about a special case. N equals 1. What is T1? What is the first Heck operator?
Well,
we're taking n equals 1, and S1 equals, so we have to think of matrices of with A times D equals 1, which completely nails down A and D, and then B is between 0 and strictly less than 1, so it's 0. So the only matrix is the identity matrix. And so what is T1 of F? Okay.
F,
right. So T1 is always the identity matrix. Or, well, I keep saying matrix, but I feel like I'm saying that for you guys. T1 is the identity linear transformation. Okay, now let's think about n equals 2. So let's figure out explicitly what S2 is. So there are two possibilities for how you're partitioning A and D up. So we'll try A equals 1, B equals 2 first, and then here B can be 0 or 1. So you have that matrix, this matrix, so 1, 0, 0, 2, and 1, 1, 0, 2, and then you have that matrix. So you have three total matrices for S2, and here the determinant is 2. So, T2, comma K of F, it's equal to, so you have to hit F by each of these, and in each case, this extra determinant factor is going to be 2 to the power of K minus 1. So I'll just put that on the outside of our sum of three things, and then, Cz plus d, I'm going to use the first one first, so that's 2 to the minus k f of z over 2 plus, did I make a mistake? No, in this case. Next one is again 2 to the minus k f of, so now if you apply this linear fractional transformation, it's z plus 1 quantity over 2. And the third one, the bottom, you know, get any extra factor, it's 1 to the minus k f of 2z. So that's it. It takes a function and it gives you back another function. It is by no means obvious that if you put a modular form in, you will get a modular form out. But it's true. The definition of it doesn't make it at all obvious. It's not even clear that, you know, even if you got put a modular form in and you got one out, maybe the weight would change, or maybe the modular form might have a different level. But don't worry, none of that happens. The level stays the same. If it's a modular form for gamma 1 of n, it stays a modular form for gamma 1 of n. And if it has weight k, it stays a weight k. But neither of those statements are obvious. That's it. That's the definition. Notice that it could be really hard to compute this if you're just given a Q expansion. If you had, say, the Q expansion of delta, how would you compute this? This would just completely mess up your Q expansion. You'd be replacing, you'd be replacing e to the z by e to the z plus 1 over 2. It's e to the 2 pi to iz by that. But it's hard to understand what's happening when you do this. So, just to tell you kind of what happens, I'll go into a little more detail, I think, next time about why this preserves MK, but I want to emphasize sort of what you get. So this is proposition 176. This is a really useful thing from the point of view of computation. So a fun but slightly tedious manipulation of a bunch of power series allows you to see that this definition here or here, in the special case of n equals 2, is equivalent to another definition on Q expansions. So here I fed in a holomorphic function, and I got out another holomorphic function. But instead you could feed in a formal power series. Let's see, what generality do I get of this Tn? And now let's say that it's some It's a holomorphic function in modular form that's given by the following. Sum n greater than n equals 0 to infinity an q to the n. Suppose it happens to be presented in this way, which is typically the way that you present a modular form. Then, here's what it is. It's equal to the sum over m going from 0 to infinity of the sum, this is a finite sum, 1 less than or equal to d dividing the GCD of n and m, d to the power of k minus 1, a sub m times m over d squared, quantity times q to the power of m. So there you are. This is a completely explicit description of how to take one q expansion and give back another one. It's just gazoon tiny. It's given a coefficient for each m. You just have to work out what this is, and it's just a sum of the divisors of something that you can compute explicitly, and then certain coefficients. It's completely explicit. Yes?
But no, it's just the typo you want it to.
Well, the typo is probably in my.
It says M and Z.
Oh, that's because in the notes I'm giving something slightly more general. In the notes I'm describing something for modular functions, so you're allowed to have poles.
Oh.
And here on the board and in the discussion in class, I've just been talking about elements of MK. And so you get a slightly different.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm just restricting to power series with no negative, without negative valuation, non-negative valuation. So it's not exactly a typo; it's just more general than it is. So this is explicit, and given what I've written right here, instead of what I've written here, and these two are completely equivalent. But given what I've written on the left, proposition 176, you could now take. Just from what I told you today, you could write down the matrix for any Heck operator acting on level 1 modular forms, right? Because I told you that using E4 and E6, you can get a basis for level 1 modular forms. I mentioned that if you put it in reduced to echelon form, you have the identity matrix followed by a bunch of integer entries. You don't really need that. This is a completely explicit formula that gives you, given an input power series, it gives you another power series. So you could take the Victor-Miller basis, which has, you know, 1 plus higher order terms, q plus higher order terms, and so on, take each of those modular forms given by a power series, put them into this formula, you get out in each case another modular form. You'll amazingly observe that in each case the thing you get out is a linear combination of the original things. And it's very, very easy to read off the linear combination because your original, your Victor-Miller basis is just diagonal with 1s down the diagonal. And if you have a basis like that, you can read off. If you have a modular form, say, I don't know, 1, or say 2 plus 7q minus 19q squared minus 47q cubed plus higher order terms, and your basis is 1 plus the higher order things, so that was f0, and then f1 was q plus higher order things, and so on. 2 is going to be, it has to be the coefficient of f0. 7 has to be the coefficient of f1 when you write this thing in terms of f0, f1, and so on. So these are exactly the coefficients of that allow you to write your output in terms of your basis. So all you do is you compute, you don't have to compute all of the infinitely many terms. All you have to do is compute the coefficients of the powers of q for the powers up to q to the d, where d is the dimension of the space. And you compute all of those. And in each case, you look at the coefficients of the thing you get out, and you put them in a matrix. You put those, make them, say, the columns of a matrix. And that is the matrix of the Heck operator. So it's a complete algorithm to compute the Heck operator T sub n at level 1. Use this formula, and use the basis given by the Victor-Miller basis. Just compute the image of the first thing, the image of the second thing, the image of the next one, and so on, you get a whole bunch of formal power series, and for each one, you take the first few coefficients of that power series, make that the column of a matrix, and that matrix is the matrix of the Heck operator. Here's an open problem, just to tell you. I can now tell you an open problem. Take n equals 2, t sub 2, on level 1, so maybe I'll state it precisely on the board here. So here's a conjecture. And this has some relation to arithmetic of motives and so on. State it precisely. It's very easy to state precisely given what I've told you in the following way. So take T2, K, acting on SK, SLTZ. So hopefully that makes sense to you right now. It's this definition here or here, they're completely equivalent. SK, SLTZ, that's the thing that's spanned by. This has a basis C times F1, C times F2, and so on. This is a Victor Miller basis. Take that matrix, let chi be its characteristic polynomial. That means the determinant of x minus. X times a minus Q2K. And then this characteristic polynomial is irreducible. So that's the conjecture, is irreducible. So, I mean, you now completely know what the statement is. It's just if you were to compute the matrix using the definition I've given you, consider its kerpoly, you get something irreducible. This has been verified by various people. Kevin Buzzard verified it for a bunch of cases, and then David Farmer and somebody else did up to 2000. Then I had an undergraduate do his junior project, I think I'm verifying it up to 3000. So it's true for K up to about 2000.
Isn't that just good enough for proof?
If you're a physicist,
just check all the
you can just check all the numbers.
If you're a physicist.
But how many numbers are left?
Infinity.
Yeah, infinity.
Still infinity.
We watched the Fermat video on Monday, so we're quoting John Conway. There's also actually a refined conjecture, which is that not only is this polynomial, this is a polynomial by the way. Integer coefficients. Not only is it irreducible, but it has Galois group S, the symmetric group S D, where D is the dimension. So, and in fact, that's what Kevin Buzzard checked in a bunch of cases. Galois group of chi should be S D, symmetric group. So that seems to be a really hard problem. My impression is that nobody has any clue how to prove it. So, although it appears to be true, very, very much so appears to be true. By the way, this is in sharp contrast to what happens if you replace SL2z by gamma 1 of n. When n is larger than 1, what you get is that the space breaks up into a bunch of pieces. The characteristic polynomial tends to factor a lot. Though as the weight gets, if you fix an n and let the weight get big, if it breaks up just as much as it has to, and it doesn't seem to break up much more than that. There's all kinds of questions related to this that are very hard to answer. Here's another question. Take delta. So this is this, it's only a Friedmann chain in S12, SL2Z. Okay, so the Ramanujan tau,
the coefficients of the Ramanujan tau function, and it's q minus 24 q squared plus 252 q cubed, and for example, 10661420 q to the 19, and so on. So the coefficients are pretty big. One knows that they're bounded in absolute value by twice the superscript over. Tau of p is less than equal to 2 p to the 11 over 12. No, I'm sorry, 11 over 2. Not 12, so 11 over 2.
That's called a Ramanujan bound, and it's a theorem.
And there's something similar true for all modular eigenforms that was proved by Deligne.
But in any case, here's a problem. Compute tau of p, the p prime, in time polynomial, time polynomial in log of t. So say you want the coefficient of q to the p, where p is a 20-digit prime. It shouldn't take a ridiculous amount of time. You should be able to do it for a 20-digit prime or a 30-digit prime in some reasonable amount of time. And that's a conjecture that you can do this. So conjecture, you can. In fact, Vasily Sovin claims that he can prove it, just that he hasn't written it down. And his techniques are extraordinarily complicated. But I certainly believe it also for various reasons. So I think it's possible. It doesn't seem to have been written down. It's a lot of work to actually try to do it in practice. I'll come back to that later when I talk about modular forms associated to elliptic curves. So I'm going to stop early, 20 seconds early, and then I'll start up again on Monday.
Are we starting only 20 seconds early?
No, we start a little late, I think.
Singular thing for the last week or so.
You've been pretty much not.
Wait, what? I haven't been doing much work on that. I do want to. Okay. I had a midterm or something this week. It's kind of bogged me down. So I will, this weekend, hopefully make more progress.
Okay, that's good. Very good. I've been, I completely rewrote the whole way this, from scratch, the whole way the stage distribution works.
Is that the one that you emailed me about?